Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and I'm calling in directly to Blog Talk today. This is not a show that's been recorded from a Revolution Radio. So it's a little different today. It's kind of good to be back to Blog Talk. I'm hoping that I'm clear. I'm hoping you can hear me clearly. We've got quite a list of things that I planned to go through today. I'm not sure if we'll make it through all these. I'm going to talk about Billy, his early life, as I usually start out every show talking about his early life for whatever reason. I'm going to talk about Svath and Aske a little while, and then I'm going to bring up some stuff I probably haven't covered much in regards to the Giza intelligences. Section 2, I want to talk about the creational natural laws. And the next 3, 4, 5, and 6 come from The Might of Thoughts, Billy's book called The Might of Thoughts, which I'm sure you're well aware of if you listen to the show. We're going to talk about weakness, purposelessness, the Lebenszeal system and order, and the danger of unsatisfaction. And if there's any time left over, I think I'm going to talk about the Talmud of Emmanuel. Now, I'm a little disconcerted because there used to be a way in Skype where I could check my signal strength, and I'm not seeing that anymore. So we'll just kind of go with the flow here and hope that everything sounds as good as it probably does. Billy Meyer is an 82-year-old man who lives in Switzerland. He's about 35 minutes east of Zurich in a place called Hinterschmidruti. Hinter means behind in the German. Schmidruti is a tiny mountain village nestled among the snow-capped mountains and the pine forests of Switzerland. Billy's about 82 years old. The story goes back to 1941, at least in this lifetime. It goes back to 1941 and in previous lifetimes, even before that. But starting back in 1941, when he lived farther north in Bulak, Switzerland, he crawled out a lower window in his bedroom on a warm, very warm May evening. There was a beautiful starry sky there, and he felt very inspired. He's only like 4 years old, and it's about 3 a.m., and he said, "My life is made out of the love of creation." And he also heard his voice say, "Since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." And he was thinking to himself that he saw the light of the stars, but he realized that there was an invisible light called the love of creation. And Billy was very touched by this revelation that he had that evening. And if you read the story, it's called How It All Began. You can look at it up on the Billy Meyer Wiki. Look up How It All Began, and there's some beautiful passages there where what actually Billy's kind of doing is speaking almost from a subconscious memory of his previous life. And later he talked about getting impulses from the storage banks. Our solar system, our planet, our galaxy, our universe has storage banks where information is stored. And if you're tuned the right way in your thinking, you can literally get these impulses and recognize them. And Billy was evidently tuned, so to speak, that way from a very young age. He could get these impulses. He's about 3 or 4 years old. But when he tried to explain this experience that he had, no one really understood, not his parents, not his friends, except maybe the pastor at his church. Pastor Rudolf Zimmerman was the only one that really had a clue of what Billy was talking about. Pastor Zimmerman had had telepathic contact with the player and himself. So, and Billy, at this time, shortly thereafter, started to get telepathic messages from a man named Spoth. Spoth was nearly 1,000 years old. He was an extraterrestrial human who lived on a planet called Era. Now, Era is in a solar system that's about 85 light years from our Pleiades system. So the Pleiades, I believe, is about 400 light years from Earth, and then some 85 light years beyond that into a different, what's called a different space-time configuration, which differs from ours by a fraction of a second. And you'll find this Pleiaren star system there. And the inhabitants that live there came from Lyra Vega about 230,000 years ago. And a man named Asael, who was their Ishwish, or that's a Lyrian term for king of wisdom, brought all these people on ships into the star system. And they terraformed three planets. Well, Era became their home world, and they actually brought plants and animals from Earth to Era. And it became very, very Earth-like and a perfect place for human beings to live. So the Pleiarens, who descended from a very powerful, very advanced warlike race called the Lyrians, they developed their own system, and they started to study nature, and they started to study what are called the laws of nature. And they still had troubles with war, and they were still making adjustments, but eventually they got to the point where they hadn't had war, I believe, in something like 20,000 years. So they're very advanced, very spiritual people. And Spoth was here on the Earth because he was aware that a very ancient spirit form was going to incarnate again. And this spirit form had been on the Earth more than seven times prior, or more than six times prior. It had been the prophets that we call Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. Now, Emmanuel, the Meyer material, call him Emmanuel. Most of the world uses the term Jesus, which actually is a bit of a misnomer. And certainly would like anyone that would want to call in or discuss this sometime to let me know what they think. But if you look at the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the Aramaic of the Old Testament, or the Koine Greek of the New Testament, there's no equivalent of the letter J. So I don't think during his lifetime he was called Jesus. Now, some people could argue reasonably that he was called Yeshua or Iesus or Emmanuel, probably other names are also possible, but I can't really make a case for calling him Jesus anymore, which was a stunning revelation to me. So somewhere along the line, people like Jeremiah and Jehovah and Job and John and James, their names began with an I or a Y in the ancient world. And for example, the book of Job was the book of IOB. Anyway, that was changed over time. And even in Old English, we didn't have the equivalent of the letter J. So even if the old ancient languages of Scripture had called him Jesus, we couldn't even translate that until about 1550, when a guy named Gian Giorgio Trevisano, an Italian scholar, invented the letter J. So the letter J is the youngest letter in our alphabet. But Spoth was here to kind of teach Billy. He was going to be his mentor. He was going to prepare Billy's material consciousness for this very important life. And Billy's Lebensziel, his life determination, is to be a prophet and a teacher, and to put what's called the creational natural laws in writing. And this is what I mentioned. I think I mentioned that briefly at the beginning of the show, that there are natural laws in our universe. So Sloth was a 1,000-year-old extraterrestrial man who landed a strange, silvery, pear-shaped craft in Bulak, Switzerland, right around 1943, and took Billy up into his ship. Billy would often say that it felt as if he was being lifted up by ghostly hands, and he'd be taken up into Billy's ship. They'd go in orbit on Earth, and as I said earlier, Sloth told Billy that he had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the person that the Meyer material calls Emmanuel and Muhammad. And Billy was told that he'd have a difficult life. They would lose his left arm in a bus accident. He was told that he would eventually get married, but his wife would turn against him, as well as other friends. But there would be other people around the world that would start to follow his teaching. And that teaching would be written down in over 40 books. And these books focus on these creational natural laws. And eventually, in about 800 years, the people of the Earth would finally discover this material in mass. And until that time, there would be little pockets of people all over the world that would study it. There's a group, two or three groups in the United States, a couple in Canada, one in Australia, one in Japan. The main group is in Switzerland. And Billy has written over 40 books. Some of the titles include The Might of Thoughts, Macht der Gedanken, The Psyche, The Art zu Leben, which is called The Way to Live, The Talmud of Emmanuel, which was a translation of an ancient scroll that Billy put many explanations in. It's a very gigantic book. And then Kelch der Wahrheit, or The Goblet of Truth, which is another one of Billy's very important writings. So Sloth was mentoring Billy the first 11 years of his life, right around, I'm thinking, 15 years old, something like that, 16 years old perhaps, in 1953. Sloth told Billy that he would get his second mentor, a woman named Askit from the Tao universe. Now, according to Meyer information, our universe has a twin universe, a parallel universe to our Dern universe. It's called the Tao universe. Both of our universes are 46 trillion years old. There are human beings in both of these universes. The people in the Tao universe, some of the people there, one group is called the Timmers. And Askit was from this group called the Timmers, and she sent to Switzerland a craft, a robotic craft, to land on a hill one evening, a hill that Billy would often meditate on this hill and think on this hill about issues in his life. And this craft came down, this robotic craft, one evening when Billy was up there, and it had a strange spherical tripod landing kind of structure that was very strange. It landed, a door opened, and Billy got in, and he felt as if he was being lifted up by ghostly hands when he got into the craft. And the ship took off with a flash of light, and then after Billy's eyes adjusted from this flashing light, he realized he couldn't see his own body or the ship, that it had become invisible. He floated off the hill over his village, hovered over his home a while, and then the ship took off upward at a tremendous rate of speed, and Billy saw an incredible sight again, these incredible stars everywhere. And he saw, when he got high enough, even the sun. And he looked down and he could see the Indian Ocean, and the ship eventually flew over the Middle East and then landed in Jordan. and he could see the red rocks and the red sand of Jordan. And Billy had stepped out of the craft, and he felt this tremendous heat. And then what looked like a falling star, he could see this little silently falling star off in the distance that got bigger and bigger and eventually huge. And he could see a 300-meter disk, which was completely silent, and landed there in the desert. And Billy had to wait a whole half an hour, and then finally when Askett stepped out, he said in his mind's eye that she looked like something like a modern angel. She was very beautiful, very striking, and when she gazed at him, he felt a pain, and he said that he had realized, that he just realized that he had missed her in his earthly existence. And of course he felt then as if he knew her, and he asked her about this, and she said that he would have to search his own feelings. Well, the two got into her spacecraft and left, and eventually landed somewhere not that far from the Giza Plateau. And Billy commented about the strange animal-human hybrid sculpture, which is the Sphinx. And the two got out of her ship. She put devices on both of their belts, which made them completely invisible, and they walked toward the Giza Plateau, and they eventually came to a tent of Bedouin women, some neighborhood women, so to speak, who were actually getting dressed and things in there. Billy goes in this tent, and he's, of course, invisible, and he plays some tricks on these women and kisses them and eventually leaves. And him and Askett go into, after some walking, she finds this underground passageway, and they go way below the Giza Plateau, and it's very, very dark, and they continue to walk in this long hallway. And eventually they come up to this, the end of the hallway, which just looks like a gigantic square rock right there in the wall. And Askett refers to it as an ashlar, which kind of shimmers and then disappears, and they both walk through. And then it becomes solid again behind them. And Billy looks around in this great hallway, and he sees light that comes from everywhere and yet nowhere. And he sees this gigantic craft and smaller ships and these guards that look very strange. And to his right, he sees like a little platform, and on that platform he sees what looks like a wooden cross and a crown of thorns and a blood-encrusted nail and a wooden staff and a purple cape and a pouch full of coins or some kind of precious stones as well. And Billy was stunned by all this, and he couldn't connect the two. He didn't know what to think, and he found it a little disturbing. He wasn't sure what to think about all this. And him and Askett left undetected, thank goodness, because they could have been killed. And they came back up to the top after quite a long walk, and I believe her and Billy spent the next 2 days talking about what Billy had seen. What Billy had seen is the underground headquarters of a group of extraterrestrials called the Giza Intelligences that I believe were on the Earth right after the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria, maybe 13,000 years ago or something to that effect. And I believe the first one, you could say, was named Eris the 11th, who had a son, Jehave, and Jehave demanded to be worshipped as a quote-unquote god, or the quote-unquote god. If you're a kind of a religious perspective, he created a tyranny. And for centuries, he was in control on the earth, and the earth people were very primitive. Jehave eventually had a son, Jehovan, and the same kind of thing was repeated again, and the sons would typically kill the fathers to come to power. And so it was very brutal, very oppressive tyranny. And they used a technology on Earth humans called these telenautic impulses, which kind of kept them entrained, so to speak. And the Gita intelligences were using religion to control the people of the earth. And then after, I believe it was Jehav, and then his son Jehovan. And then I believe Jehovan had a son, Erasim, who tried to usurp his father's power, but was fought off by his two brothers, Ptah and Solomon. And eventually, Erasim came back to the earth and went into these old cubicle constructions, 73,000-year-old cubicle constructions that are far below the earth. And then Erasim eventually was kicked out of power by his nephew, Hen, who the Maya people say was the God of the Old Testament, Jehovah, the same person, who was just a person who claimed to be the creator of the universe, wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah with two small nuclear weapons, and eventually he himself was pushed out of power by a guy named Comegal the First, who reigned for quite some long time, and then he was pushed out of power by his son, Comegal the Second. Now, Comegal the Second was alive in modern times. These Giza intelligences were here until about 1975, 76, maybe 79. I can't remember exactly. But Comegal the Second influenced Hitler through the Fool Society. The Giza intelligences had an emissary named Hermann Steinschneider, who went as under the name Eric Janison, who influenced Hitler and kind of pushed him towards world domination. And eventually Hitler succumbed to this pressure and became kind of a psychopath that tried to rule the world. Now, originally the Pleiaron themselves had kind of impulsed Hitler, and he would have been actually a great leader if the Giza intelligences would have left him alone. So anyway, I know that's a lot of stuff that people have probably heard before, although some may never have heard this before. And then some may be like me, and then never get tired of hearing it, which is very interesting. I want to just read a little bit about the Giza intelligences, a little bit extra information. In May in 1978, following their attack, the Giza intelligences, so the Pleiaron put up an invisible shield. It was installed over the Semyase Silver Star Center. Yeah. These Giza intelligences were captured, arrested, deported, stripped of all the technology except the most basic survival equipment, and permanently incarcerated on a remote prison planet by the Pleiaron Federation. And that was in 78. Well, they have these telenautic impulses that they subjected the people of the earth to that will continue to linger for the next 200 or 300 years. And just as a quick, what is their agenda, or what was their agenda? For thousands of years, they deceived earth humankind with religious miracles and visions of every kind in order to maintain and to yet further increase the religious delusion, with the plan that eventually they would appear as angels and gods, as they had done in earlier times, and subjugate a voluntarily worshipful earth humankind. They also had an alternative plan whereby they would also try to reach their goal by barbaric violence and a third world war. 2/3 of the terrestrial humanity would have been annihilated and die a horrible death. And I had just told you about the layer under the Giza Plateau. Well, Comegal, who I told you about before, forced all the terrestrial religions into the frame of blood-demanding cults, which unfortunately were maintained on the earth up until the current time. So that's kind of and there's more here we could cover, believe me. It's all very interesting stuff. But I wanted to just cover briefly, I know we're already the time is zooming away, and I don't want to miss too much here, but I wanted to just cover a little bit that we had maybe touched on a long time ago. This is Contact Report 38, and Quetzal, who's one of Billy's contacts, is talking about these Giza intelligences. And let me just read a few lines here, and then we'll move on and leave it the way it is. Quetzal says, "Be greeted, my friend. It is an edifying joy for me to be able to come to you another time. This time I will give you explanations that Sannyasa has spoken about with you in relation to the events surrounding Ashtar Sharon, who in truth was named Arisak, and carries further names still. So then follow my words exactly and comprehend what I have to say to you. Every form of life is subject to the change of progressive evolution. Consequently, it collects cognitions and truth. Negative and positive powers become transformed in the balance and therewith, thus the power of life and constancy. The path of evolution is very long and burdensome, and it is marked by many kinds of external influences. In particular, the influences of the same kind of forms of life exert powers over a single form of life, which this form of life is only able to control through living through greater spaces of times and teachings, from which understanding and recognition result. This course of evolution belongs to the high and the highest forms of life, just as it does to the low and the lowest forms. There is a creational law of evolution which possesses its validity for all times, and it is never subject to any kinds of alterations. This is why this law has also validity for Arisak, who, out of certain grounds, is known to you from counts as Ashtar Sharon. Because, therefore, also he is subject to this law, like all his co-workers, and also those who were before him, understanding and recognition for them is and was inelectable. Even though it has also lasted a very long time, indeed, the point in time came when certain things had to change the progression of the recognition of truth. In connection with Arisak, concerning the direct and indirect, there is the following. Arisak, alias Ashtar Sharon, and so forth, is as far as the fulfillment of the aforementioned apportioned mission is concerned, the leader of an assembly of intelligences consisting of thousands of individuals who until 15 years ago stood under the direct force command of the world-seeking Kamigal. Arisak and Kamigal are, according to their blood association, cousins, as it is named by you. But Kamigal is a leader and ruler over a splinter group of many thousands of descendants who in earlier times were separated, which means that this group had been separated by those powers who earlier possessed control over the earth and whose highest leader was an Ishwish. And I don't know that I want to read too much more than that. Anyway, Arisak, or Ashtar Sharon, had eventually evolved, and started to kind of go down a more spiritual path. Now, there's a lot of interesting stuff here, and we can cover this hopefully on a later show. But that's Contact Report 38. You can find that up on the Future of Mankind site and read a little bit more for yourself. I want to go to the creational natural laws now. I want to do a quick review of those because this is one of the things that the Meyer teaching is all about. But you get just a little bit here, and a little bit there, and a little bit here, and a little bit there. So I like to kind of put it together for you if it's possible. Now, the first creational natural law is love. And I think in order to really appreciate that creational natural law, I like to go back to the creation itself. I mean, how can you understand the creational natural laws and unless you talk about the creation, right? So the creation is identical to the term universal consciousness. So our universe has a consciousness and intelligence. but no personality. The universe that we live in is the material manifestation of the wisdom of this consciousness. Everything which exists in the whole universe is a manifestation of the might and the infinite true love of this universal consciousness. So what does that mean? Well, it means this, that this intelligence has as an attribute love. Now, this is the highest form of love. It's an effective love. It has nothing to do with romance. And our love for everything and everyone is supposed to be the same kind of love. Now, this love is described this way, and I think this is very profound. It says, the incredible splendor of nature is a visible expression of the love of creation. So if you're observing nature, if you're walking in the woods, which I highly recommend, I took a fantastic hike in the woods yesterday, or the day before, it was the day before. Beautiful, beautiful area here, and just a stunning green everywhere, and rolling hills and flowing water and like trees, beautiful large trees with green leaves everywhere. Just me and the dog were walking on the bike trails. It was just stunning. So if you look at nature and you're really sensitive, you get this eventually a fine sensitive feeling. And it's explained this way. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of love of creation. So the universal consciousness doesn't express its love to you verbally. It is a visible expression. And it can have sounds. You can hear running water. You can hear birds chirping. But the impact is visual. And it's the love of creation is a fantastic thing. So I recommend you get out there and experience this for yourself. So this is the first creational natural law. This is closer to brotherly love or family love. It has nothing to do with romance. It's very stable. It brings a very peace to you. The second creational natural law is the law of striving. Striving can be, you know, you're working at your day job. Say I'm a computer programmer, so I'm writing computer programs. But I also do other kinds of striving. For example, I work on this program, and I learn things while I'm preparing and learn things while I'm doing this program. So this is the fundamental law of all evolution. Without striving, there is no life. Now, evolution is also a creational natural law. It's tied in with striving, but striving gives you your sense of life. If you're depressed, if you're having some downtime, you may need to push even harder on your striving. And there are times I know when I've had to strive harder than I thought I could even stand to strive to keep up with what I had to do. So let me read from page 102, and this is from the Way to Live book. It says, to be without striving means unwillingness and affliction. So if you are not striving, you will be afflicted. Affliction is inhibited striving and inhibited life, but inhibited striving and the inhibited life bring inhibited evolution. So if you're not striving enough, you're going to stagnate your evolution. You inhibit your evolution. You will stagnate. You'll have hopelessness, grief, confusion. So don't do that. Keep striving. Striving is extremely important for your happiness. This is a creational natural law. Striving is learning. Striving is simple things, even raking outside, cleaning your garage. Just continue to strive. Organize. Organize your closet. Continue striving. Striving is also related to another creation natural law, which is called system and order. the more you strive, you should produce a system and order in your life. There'll be a time to do this, a time to do that. You go from one thing to another. Now, the third creational law that I'm going to talk about is called the law of harmony. This one is I've spent the most of my time studying the law of harmony, which is found in the Might of Thoughts book, Mach der Gedanken. So, the law of harmony says that you should think in a neutral, positive way. That means you've got positive and negative balance in your thinking. And your positive balance, you're a little stronger on the positive side, but not a whole lot. So, you tell yourself, I tell myself, I'm confident, I'm optimistic, I'm relaxed, I'm cheerful, I'm enthusiastic, I'm the master of my own destiny, I'm the forger of my own fortune, I create my own good luck. I do not allow my thoughts to drift on the ocean of life. I steer my thoughts like a captain steers his ship. I do not allow my thought boat to drift on the ocean of conscious and unconscious intentions. I do not allow the helm to be ripped away from my hands while I steer my ship. So tell yourself you're the master of your own destiny, the forger of your own fortune. Clarify your thoughts. I clarify my thoughts. I strengthen my thoughts. I nurture my thoughts. It is the nature of the thoughts that by their might alone, anything can be brought into fruition. Any conceivable thing can be brought into fruition. So that's the law of harmony. So that is what I spend most of my time talking about. How do we create a harmony in our thinking? How do we detect when we've lost that harmony? How do we recover that harmony? Recovering the harmony, just think of something neutral. Like, you know, I'm raking some hay in my yard. Think of something neutral, like I'm pulling, you know, walking up the hill with my garbage can, dragging my garbage can behind me. I'm walking the dog. Something neutral. It can be a wish dream. It can be really nice, like if you have this beautiful summer day and you're playing with your cats or whatever is your wish dream. These are ways to recover neutrality, to see, because the universe, this intelligence that's behind everything, is very neutral. It's neutral positive. It's called a Wesenheit in the German. We are Wesen as human beings, as animals. We have a personality. Wesenheit do not. Stones, gases, I don't think trees have a personality. I don't think plants, maybe you could argue they do. I know some plants have a male and a female, including trees, but these are very subtle sex characteristics. So when I use trees as an example of neutral gender, even though technically that's probably not correct, trees are a good way to think of the way the creation is, I think. They're very neutral. They have no personality, as far as we know. And their sex is very hard to detect. The universal consciousness has no gender. So that's the law of harmony. Your thinking is neutral, positive. You're relaxed. You're optimistic. You're cheerful. You're enthusiastic. But you know that life has difficulties. So there's a negative inclusion in your thought process. Most of our thoughts are negative. Many of our thoughts are deeply negative in our subconscious. And when we're not paying attention, like I was talking about the thought boat drifting, you're drifting along, that's when what comes back from the subconscious are these old programs, old thoughts, old feelings which come forward. And pretty soon, you're feeling negative things. Well, the feelings come from the thoughts. They grow from the thoughts. And these negative feelings can start a vicious cycle in your thinking. And that's the worst thing to be caught in. Use the wish dream. Think of something neutral. I a lot of times will quote things directly from the Meyer material, like, love is the highest principle in all creation, and through it everything exists in absolute logic. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. Or something like, I always remain relaxed, and thereby gain might over myself. So anyway, this is the law of harmony. We talk first of all about the law of love. The law of striving, which is so critical, you'll spend most of your time striving. The law of harmony is there to keep your striving productive. So these two work together, the law of striving and the law of harmony. If you're striving away and you're suddenly becoming angry and depressed and you feel you're not satisfied, you know, something's not working out with your striving, well, this is when you fall back on the law of harmony. You slow down on the striving, use your recovery techniques, take a little time to rest, and bring your thinking back into harmony. Now, if you function under the law of love, the law of striving, the law of harmony, then the law of prosperity and abundance kicks in, and you will have plentiful abundance in order to be able to live and evolve. Now, really, the law of prosperity and abundance is for every life form, but we are violating so many creational natural laws, particularly those related to overpopulation. So these kind of things get interrupted. The law of universal creation says that every thought that is enlivened by might and power must, as a cause, also bring a quite certain effect, and the effect of the thought is directly proportional to the might and power. So just to repeat again, first of all, we have the law of love, effective love, creation is love. The law of striving, the fundamental law of all evolution. We continue to work, we continue to strive. Without striving, there is no life. Third law is the law of harmony. The bipolar structure of everything that exists, the positive and the negative, we need to think in harmonious ways. We must have a neutral, positive balance in our thinking. If you follow the first three laws, you have a very good chance that the law of prosperity and abundance will occur in your life. And the law of universal creation says that every thought enlivened by might and power will have an effect, and that effect is directly proportional to the might and power of the thoughts. So the more power, the more directed, the more purpose your thoughts have, the more power they have. So I was going to jump to something I consider to be very important and something that's been on my mind as of late in my studies of the book, The Might of Thoughts. And it deals with something called weakness. And we all feel weak at times. And we have to fight against this weakness. We also have to, and this is from Might of Thoughts, page 166. It says, but this means that weakness and purposelessness must be combated and dismantled. And a new start has to find its place in one's thoughts. So if you're feeling purpose, like you have no purpose, and this is so funny, you can have a million different interests in life, you know, things can be going good, you know, you're gainfully employed, you just like all these different areas of your life flowing right along, and then suddenly you feel weak and you feel like you have this purposelessness kind of shrinking in on you or falling in on you for some reason. Well, this something we have to combat, and it's something we have to dismantle. So let me read just a little bit. This is on page 166 in the book called The Might of Thoughts. Just as a physically weak human being can build themselves up and strengthen themselves physically and even psychically by means of an intentional, patient, and careful physical training, Also, human beings with weak thoughts are able to strengthen themselves and to build themselves up. If they form their thoughts correctly and form the absolutely necessary setting of the zeal for the life, the Lebenszeal, the life determination. But that means that weaknesses and purposelessness must be combated and dismantled, and a new start has to find its place in one's thinking. The new thoughts must be formed with the intention to strip away that which is old and inadequate, and only to acknowledge and follow that which is progressive, powerful, and strengthening. New setting of the zeal must be carried out. The term zeal is very difficult, I think, in some ways. I'm still trying to understand it. A simple translation would be goal, but I don't think that's correct, because Billy never lets that be. Any of these German words related to zeal are never translated with an English word. Like, there's the German word Lebenszeal, which is your life determination. There's never the word goal or target in there. So really, it has a unique meaning in German. Lebenszeal, life determination, is a reasonable translation for that. So we've got to combat our own weakness. We've got to combat and dismantle, take it apart, your sense of purposelessness. I think sometimes we get unrealistic in our thinking and our desires. I think my weakness is that I fall back into a kind of pessimism. At times I have feelings that are having a vague sort of negativity. So weakness is defined as the state or condition of lacking strength. And for whatever reason, I go through little periods now again where I'm not feeling my normal, strong attitude. And for some reason, my thoughts are drained of their power, and I've lost my enthusiasm. You know, one thing, it really feels good when you're enthusiastic. And that means that your Lebenszeal is working. Your life determination, your Lebenskraft is working, your life power is working. But when you go through these stages where life feels like it is kind of purposelessness, and this is absurd because we all have so many different interests, it's true that you can have this unhealthy thinking. So the key is to get your vigor back. And a lot of times I have to go through the repetition. I'm confident, I'm optimistic, I'm relaxed, I'm cheerful, I'm enthusiastic, I'm the master of my own destiny, the forger of my own fortune. I have good thoughts, good feelings, good habits, good circumstances in my life. My consciousness is like a garden filled with flourishing plants. There's a German word, schwachen, which can mean to, can be defined as an inability. And we shouldn't focus on our inabilities, we should focus on our capabilities. And we all have thoughts. And if our thoughts can have intensity, then those thoughts, those intense thoughts, will have an effect. It's a law of nature. Now, there's this thing called doubt as a shortcoming, and the maintenance of doubt has in no way anything to do with a healthy, logical, and knowledge-demanding searching for the truth. So, get rid of doubt. Doubt can be combated by getting a clear vision and a clear recognition of where you are, what you want to do. So do not allow doubt to come in. Do not let weakness to come in. Do not let yourself fall into purposelessness. So there's this creational natural law called system and order, and that can help you fight these weak feelings. System and order. The whole universe is maintained in this law of system and order. Universal love is embedded, which by its own effort, each form of life must acquire a universal love. If you want to be happy, healthy, and successful in the material life, then you need to structure your life, and you need to adhere to this structure. So you need a life. This is a creational natural law. I need to put this on my list. It's called system and order. I think about this, and I'll just repeat system and order, system and order, system and order. It helps. It gives you back a sense of purpose when you are falling into feeling a little of purposelessness. So your daily life has to be structured and adhered to in every respect. And if you control your daily life, you can also learn to get some quiet and distance yourself from surrounding disturbances. And this is very important for studying what's called the Geisteslehre or the spirit teachings. It can help you with your meditation. So this is the law of system and order. It's a creational natural law. I wanted to quickly, if I can actually do this, you know, I have so many notes, I get lost in my notes. But I want to talk a little bit about satisfaction, I should talk unsatisfaction, because I think this is something that can torment people, and because it takes away your initiative, so you have to be very careful that you don't fall into unsatisfaction. It can happen. The danger of unsatisfaction. So many human beings are not satisfied with what they have. They want to be thinner. They want to be more muscular. This can result in lack of confidence. And you can be plagued by these inner conflicts. You can squander your energy on these inner conflicts, which will cause you to lose your initiative. You won't be motivated. So we all need to pull ourselves together. Initiative is the power or opportunity to act, to make something change. So do not allow your energy to be squandered with inner conflicts. Do not allow this to drain your energy. Do not fall into the abyss of despair. Do not get on your own nerves. The truth of the existence of human unsatisfaction, namely, lies entirely elsewhere, and indeed in the human being himself or herself who produces it through unfulfillable and unreal ideas. So if you're getting unsatisfied at your work or in your relationship or unsatisfied with something, look at that and see are you being a little unrealistic? Are you having unrealistic expectations at work? You know, I mean, come on. Think about it honestly. Are you being a little bit, are you trying to set your standards so high, and then, you know, of course, that doesn't get met? And are you a little unsatisfied in your relationship? Are you having unrealistic expectations? This is from Might of Thoughts, page 280. Unsatisfaction is therefore devastating and destructive, and therefore in no wise such that a certain amount of it is necessary. So you never need unsatisfaction. It's not necessary in order to reach a certain zeal at all. Unsatisfaction is unable to create any ideas or any balance of personality. Consequently, you cannot get progress or success from unsatisfaction. Unsatisfaction kills all initiative for striving for that which is higher and lets the human being sink into brooding misery. Do not fall into this. I believe it's called Unzufriedenheit. Unzufriedenheit in the German, unsatisfaction. So that's a law to look out for. Do not fall into unsatisfaction. It'll destroy your initiative. I think last time, or one of the last times we got together on Revolution Radio, we were talking about creation. I'm going to read a little bit about creation in the last 5 minutes. What is creation? The creation is an immense, neutral, energetic, and evolutive Wesenheit being. Remember, we're Wesen. We have a personality. The creation is an immense, neutral, energetical, and evolutive Wesenheit being that is not a Wesen as such, but a Wesenheit as a pure natural state of energy, a natural evolutive spirit, energetical, active energy. The Wesenheit creation is pure spirit, energetical being state, creation life state. A radiating energy of spirit light, and therefore not a Wesen in the sense of a human being or other creature or other personified Wesen. So also not a divinity in a superhuman form. A Wesen is an independently existing life form with its own individuality and personality in an impulse, instinct, or conscious form that is specifically directed towards all possibilities of evolution and with its own physical, psychical, conscious, part conscious, unconscious, impulse, or instinct-based developmental forms, meaning human beings, animals, creatures, and plants. So perhaps there is a bit of an impulse personality in plants. I do not know. A Wesenheit is not a Wesen as such, but an immaterial or material form of existence without a self-determining possibility of evolution. So the creation universal consciousness evolves according to its own pattern. Let me read this again. A Wesenheit is not a Wesen as such, but an immaterial material form of existence without a self-determining possibility of evolution. But where this possibility can be given to a certain extent, such as the creational universal consciousness, with certain energies, stones, water, and gases, etc. I think I'm very, very close to running out of time here. And a very interesting study this afternoon. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too. And I think the studio here on Blog Talk has changed just a little bit. So bear with me. The title of the show today was Unsatisfaction Kills Off All Initiative. So don't fall into the trap of unsatisfaction, because it'll kill all your initiative, all of your striving towards that which is higher. It's devastating and destructive, and it will not help you with any kind of progress or success. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We'll be talking to you tomorrow. We've got a couple guests on Revolution Radio. Should be different. Have a great day, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.